Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Let Me Tell You podcast from the Irish Examiner. In this podcast, we are looking at some of the most dramatic events in recent Irish political history from the unique perspective of one of the key players. With the 50th anniversary of Ireland's entry into Europe upon us, we want to look at today are the events surrounding the 2012 euro crisis and the secret plans to reprint the Irish currency, the punt. With me here today to discuss his pivotal role in that episode is former Labour Party leader and then Minister for Public Expenditure Reform and, of course, current Wexford TD, Brendan Howland. You're very welcome to the podcast.
Delighted to be here.
Now, before we go into the heart of the matter, we have a small clip here to sort of set the scene for yourselves and our listeners as well. So,
let's begin this afternoon with the crisis in the Eurozone. President Obama today meeting with members of the European Union here in Washington. The meeting comes at a time in which many see the Eurozone as being on life support, after economic collapse seems to be spreading. Now, we've already seen Greece, Portugal, and Ireland bailed out, but now the Eurozone's third and fourth largest economies, Italy and Spain, are also under threat. Today's meeting is seen by some as a last-ditch attempt to save the Eurozone, with even some top experts predicting the Eurozone has just 10 days left to live if a major solution is not found by its next meeting on December 9th.
Brendan Howland, that's a clip from American TV from Midway in 2011. You took office in March 2011 with a huge majority with Fine Gael. From your recollection, what were the warnings that you were being given, or what was the sense of how deep the crisis was when you took office at that time?
Well, we knew the crisis was very, very deep. The most profound economic challenge the country had faced probably since independence. I suppose it started in 2008. Ireland was the first Eurozone country to go into a recession, and things catapulted very quickly. We had mass unemployment, 80,000 additional people unemployed within a year. And then I suppose things crystallised in 2010 when basically the then government fell apart. And I suppose politically, that's why, you know, we had to do a lot of thinking. It would be much easier for us to walk away at that stage. But we went into government knowing that we really probably needed the strength of the two largest parties in the Dáil working together to drag Ireland out of what we were facing into.
And not only was there, as you well articulated there, the Irish domestic problem, but there was obviously the euro-wide crisis. Just talk to me about what soundings were you getting about that wider crisis in your initial days and after taking office?
Yeah, well, we thought things were terribly, terribly, terribly bad. Mm. But things got immeasurably worse because what I suppose people saw as an Irish crisis for Europe became a European crisis for Ireland in terms of the potential impact of the collapse of one of the major currencies, the withdrawal of a country. The one that most came into focus in 2012 was Italy. And it was crystal clear to us if Italy withdrew from the euro itself might well implode. And that was one of the most tense periods in the summer of 2012 when we had to prepare ourselves for that potential happening. It was the most difficult period, as I say, since independence in my judgment, because we genuinely, day to day, didn't know whether Ireland economically could survive. We were fighting on so many fronts at that time. And at the same time, we weren't dealing with shrinking violets in the Troika, who were doing a monthly accounting, and we had to be there to ensure that the targets we had agreed with them would be set. At the same time, trying to constantly adjust the targets to make it more palatable.
And in terms of, the focus of this podcast really is around the currency and around that sort of series of events. And again, going back on my notes, I get the sense that from the summer of 2011, that there were teams between the Department of Finance, Public Expenditure Reform, as one entity, and the Central Bank, were beginning to have discussions around like this is now a viable possibility. You know, scenario testing was beginning to happen. You might just talk us through, from your perspective, what were those discussions and who was involved at that stage?
Well, all the discussions happened at the EMC. The Economic Management Council was the pivotal engine. It was the war cabinet.
And just so we can explain, this was the four-man inner cabinet between yourself, Enda Kenny, Michael Noonan and Eamon Gilmore.
Yeah, and key officials, obviously, the Secretary General to the government, each of our secretaries general, and a new secretary facilitating the work of the EMC itself. So they were. That was essentially the war cabinet that was trying to deal with these things, crisis by crisis, and defuse as many bombs as we could. It was clear from us that, as I said, things got worse very quickly after we entered government because of external factors. Contagion in the banks, the danger that either Spain or Italy or both
could topple
and bring everybody down. And that concern grew right through 2012 and I suppose culminated in the summer of 2012 when we actually had to put into place some strategic decisions because this thing could happen very quickly. Mm. And, you know, I think there were some guffaws when... when Enda Kenny said, likely at one stage, that...
We have a clip on this where we've literally got an interview. This is, you might play the second clip here, Paul, but...
The governor of the central bank in Ireland said to me, it looks like this weekend, this is a few years ago, you will have to put the army around the banks and around the ATM machines and introduce capital controls like they had in Cyprus. So we pulled back from that brink.
As you say, there were gas, and I remember a week-long sort of investigation as, did that actually happen? Was it said? Was it not said? Like, again, I didn't, not to stop you in mid-track, continue what you were...
No, I mean, that was the nature of the conversation. You see, looking back from the shoreline, you know, once you've sailed the vessel into safe harbour, these things look so bizarre, so strange. But that was an extraordinary time. We obviously had to be very restricted in the number of people who could be aware that we were planning for the return of the punt. I mean, it became black humour. I mean, whose face would we put on the pound, the new Irish pound that we would have to do? How long would we take to print? And we actually had practical presentations in terms of how long would it take to print notes, how long would it take to print coins, how long would we have to close the banks. How would people access credit for the period of time?
Did it have a name? Because I'm often wondered, like, you know, these have Operation Mongoose or Operation...
No, I don't. I mean, some of the operations we had, for example, the liquidation of the IBRC was Operation Red or Project Red. And somehow near the very end, it was always Project Red, but sometime near the very end it became Project Dawn at the very end.
Yes.
But this, because we were so... petrified of this leaking out. But this, I don't recall this having a name, but I do recall, you know, we had to do things like bring in the Secretary General of my department to see if we were going to procure paper to print money without obviously going through public procurement, and secondly, without alerting people, why is the Irish government buying an awful lot of paper for currency?
Yeah.
So all these things had to be planned for. And it was a really, really challenging time because nobody knew what the consequences of a collapsed euro would be. I mean, the shock waves of the collapse of the second largest currency in the world at the time wouldn't be confined to Europe. It would be an earthquake across the globe. And we had to try and see how in that context. I remember direct contact being made from the Sycamore Room to the financial treasury in Washington, as well as with the ECB, to try and take this incrementally, how we would manage it and how we would contain as best we could the fallout from it. Now, all of this without anything leaking out, because as soon as you whisper currency collapse, you actually become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, and again, because it was interesting, because I remember, I think I like people like Sean Fleming you know, would have put down parliamentary questions at the time. I'm sure there were media queries. It did become a bit of an open, I won't say secret, but it was certainly became an open topic of discussion around the chattering classes in Dublin. Did at any point did you fear that this was getting out, that there was a kind of a, it was kind of getting to the point where this is just now almost, it's not sustainable to continue on in the denials, I suppose, as
they were? I mean, the bottom line is that any economist would look at what was happening across the Eurozone, and there was endless speculation about the viability of various economies at the time. So that was a daily narrative, and that couldn't be escaped. We just had to present ourselves as confidently as we could, but at the same time prepare for the worst. Even in the midst of this, we didn't expect it to actually happen, but we knew we had to prepare for it because so many unimaginable things had happened in the previous 4 years.
Can I ask you a frank question? Because again, when you're obviously trying to protect something as delicate and as sensitive as this, do you agree amongst yourselves that there is a position or a line up to which you're prepared, I won't say lie, but certainly not tell the truth in relation to this in terms of containment? Or was there just a point saying, if we start getting direct queries on this, we'll have to fess up? Or did those discussions even take place?
No, those discussions didn't take place because, I mean, in essence, everybody knew who could look at the economy, and there was endless, as I say, commentators that this was a possibility. The only thing we didn't want to go out is that we were actively preparing for reacting to such a possibility. And I don't recall anybody asking me the direct question, well, is there a law drafted? Do you have a design for money? What are you going to do in terms of securing credit, protecting deposits and so on in those eventualities? But they were the sort of things we were preparing for.
And speaking of which, you raised the issue of a new face on the punt. Did you actually ever decide as to who the new face
would be? No. I mean, I think the black humour was that we'd have to put Michael Dees.
Michael Dees. But in terms of those negotiations, because my understanding is what Anne Nolan, who was the head of the banking division, would have been the main liaison between the department and the central bank. Am I right on that?
Yes.
So, and again,
she would have attended the EMC as well.
Okay.
As well as the Secretary General of the Department of Finance.
And there would have been essentially a war room established. I don't know. But at its height, at the most tense moment, and we're supposed into 2012 at this stage, I mean, how frequently were you discussing this? How frequently were you meeting on this? Or how much oxygen and time was this issue taking up?
We were meeting every week. The EMC met every Wednesday afternoon, but we had so many other things to be dealing with. This wasn't a constant issue that we discussed very frequently. I remember one full meeting when it was very precarious that we did discuss it, and then we'd reference it until such time as it disappeared off the horizon. We were aware from the previous confrontation we had with the European Central Bank in relation to buying in the bondholders early on in our administration, when Trichet, in a conversation with Michael Noonan, made it clear that the ECB wouldn't tolerate what the government had determined would do and what we had committed in advance of the election to do, which was burn the senior bondholders. That would be worth about 3 billion euros at the time, 3.5 billion or thereabouts. And it was agreed by government. The Dáil was about to be informed of it. The speaking note was done. I had actually briefed the Parliamentary Labour Party and walked over to the Dáil chamber. Yeah. Michael Noonan came in late, if you recall.
I remember it well, remember well.
And he had four pages, and he was so flustered he read them out in the wrong order, but nobody noticed. But in essence, the liquidity that we were dependent on to sustain our currency was threatened, and we just couldn't afford to take that risk at that stage. And I say this because that obviously conditioned us in relation to the next decisions we had to make. And if you think that was an idle threat from the ECB, have a look at what happened to Greece.
And I suppose the natural kind of follow-on from that is that when you're in these very heavy discussions and you're at the point of it, you know, getting tense, and you talked about getting very close to actioning a plan, had you actioned that plan, what would it actually have looked like? What would have happened had you pressed the button on it?
We don't know, I suppose. We would have had to close the banks temporarily, and the debate was, could we get away with closing for 3 days, or would it have to be longer? And it probably would have had to have been longer. How would we stop a panic? The idea of having some sort of security in the banks to stop a run, people physically, as happened in Greece subsequently, queuing up outside, banging on the doors, looking for their money. And of course, the euro, which was their currency, would no longer be available. And we would have had to fix a new rate for our free-floating pound, and then it would have to find its own value in an international market. That wouldn't have been a very happy set of circumstances, as you can imagine.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, I mean, you say,
was there a contingency even, say, for using digital transactions? Like, would you have used your bank card as opposed to the currency? Some of my sources in the bank have said that, you know, there had been some, there may have been a case where you could have had the euro currency but with some form of a sticker on it, or there may have been other options on the table.
Virtual euro and all these things. I remember being in Moscow when the ruble collapsed, and I was staying in a hotel. And suddenly, they said that everything is now no longer priced in rubles; it's priced in units of currency. But nobody knew what the value of units of currency. So you went in to order your dinner, and it was 35 units of currency.
Currency.
But until you paid for it at the end, you didn't know what you were paying for, or how much it was. Mm. So that's when your currency disappears. That's the sort of surreal territory that you disappear into.
Did the government act throughout that period? Were you and Fine Gael at one in relation to that? Was it a kind of a unified approach, or were there disagreements or arguments as to the approach in relation to this, or was the situation just so stark that...
No, there was no... I mean, if literally the euro collapsed, which is something we had no control over, we had to have a contingency plan for that. And a contingency plan required us to have our own currency of some description.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that wasn't a point of debate. That was a point of necessity. And we had to prepare all the extraordinariness that involved.
Do you know, at any point, was the new currency even printed? Did you see any of the new currency or any of that kind of stuff?
No, we never got to that stage at all.
Okay.
Not even in design terms.
Okay.
No.
And in terms of the, I suppose... the plan that would have been exercised, would you have waited, would it have been an Irish call to pull the trigger, or would it, say, have been a call from Brussels or Frankfurt to make the, in terms of pulling the trigger ultimately?
Well, we'd have to, we were coordinating both with Frankfurt, with other European partners, and with the United States.
Mm.
But, I mean, as we discovered again and again, in an absolute and complete crisis, quite often you're on your own.
Mm. Now, obviously, salvation came in the form of Mario Draghi when he took over the ECB, and we have a clip of Super Mario as he was dermed, and let's take a quick listen.
In July 2012, the European Central Bank's then-president Mario Draghi gave a speech that is now credited with saving the euro.
The ECB is ready to do whatever it takes to preserve the euro. And believe me, it will be enough.
Greece was in the middle of a debt crisis, and economic instability was spreading to other parts of the eurozone. The ECB, the central bank for the countries that have adopted the euro, had to act.
From an Irish perspective, Brendan Howland, what impact did that policy change from Mario Draghi have? And was that the key changer or the key matter or event that took that risk of a euro collapse off the table?
In my judgment, yes. I think that in terms of a personnel change, nothing was more valuable and more important than the replacement of Trichet by Draghi.
Mm. And I presume, were there champagnes popped in Dublin at that eventuality? Or
we were too exhausted.
Too exhausted.
Too exhausted and too frazzled. I do remember, literally, you know, just to clear your head, walking down out of Merrion Street and walking down Baggot Street and looking at people going around their normal business and saying, what are they doing? Be normal. They only knew how close we are to ruination.
Yeah, yeah.
And even afterwards, even now, looking back, it almost seems surreal how close we came to complete peril. Mm. And I find that still, in judging actions of that period, as if we were in normal circumstances, as opposed to literally fighting a war.
Mm. Given what you said in terms of the lack of realisation by the Irish public as to what actually happened or how close we were, was it a mistake then, from a communications perspective, not to articulate that more clearly at the time?
That's a very, very good question that I've thought about a lot. And I think the answer is probably yes. You see, we had, I suppose, three different objectives. One, we had to do the best we can to fix things.
Mm.
Two, we had to keep the confidence of external investors that we were going to succeed, which was critical. Confidence was critical. And the third thing, we had to keep some level of morale in the Irish public to stay with the programme and to stay with us, because a disintegration of public support would have been ruinous for the state as well. So if you ask me, just in terms of the entire period of government, from a Labour Party perspective, I think we internalised too much of the difficulties, too much of the sometimes conflict we had with Fine Gael.
Mm.
We didn't articulate that to people. I think the Greens have done much better since, in much calmer times, in saying, actually, that's not our point of view, this is our point of view.
Mm.
But we were so petrified that internal dissent in government that became publicly known would undermine the whole reconstruction strategy and undermine people, investors' confidence in Ireland Inc., that we allowed all of that to be internalised, which put enormous strains on us in the system, but I think probably did help the journey to salvation, if you want to put it that way, but at great political cost to us.
Dare I say, did the scars of 1982 to 1987 loom large in the thinking of some of you in terms of that very difficult relationship between Fine Gael and Fine Gael and Labour on the economy under Garrett and Dick Spring?
Well, I obviously was very peripheral around around the place in that period.
Yeah.
But yes, I actually think that, and certainly I would advise any future Labour involved in government to be much more upfront and clear about what we're doing, about the differences or difficulties we're having, even if it is a point of difficulty for the government. To be clear about that, so that, you know, when I remember in the 90s, when the government fell apart in 94, it came as a complete shock to ourselves, you know, our own parties as well.
Mm.
Because we hadn't prepared people for the ongoing difficulties that the two parties were having at that stage. So more external dialogue with the people and to bring as many people with you as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is easier said than done in the current age of social media, because where everything is reduced to a soundbite and nothing is contextualised.
Mm. Looking back at that period, I mean, obviously, I vividly remember Tommy Bruin and others in O'Reilly Hall and UCD, you know, before you went into government, saying we're going to be hammered for this, and this is not the right thing to do. Do you have any personal regrets about going into government in 2011?
Well, I negotiated. I led the negotiations for the programme for government, and we were briefed, obviously, during that process, by the central bank, by the Department of Finance at the time, by external actors like the Troika, and we knew what was ahead of us, but we also knew what the consequences of not taking on that challenge would be. I mean, I know talking to Eamon, and I've talked to Eamon about this subsequently, it is something certainly he contemplated, because I think that had we not gone in, Fine Gael would have been in government, would certainly have been, they would have implemented their strategy, which was a much tougher ratio of cuts to income tax rise or to tax rises than ours was. On balance, over our 5 years in government, the ratio was about 50-50. That is, tax rises to service cuts. They wanted a ratio of 3-1.
Mm-hmm.
And Leo, of course, wanted famously 4-1. I think that would have been unbearable for the Irish people. I don't think that government would have lasted. And we probably would have gained hugely in a subsequent election. Mm-hmm. But we then would have been in government with a much weaker and worse economy, because things would have deteriorated further. So you can't rewrite history. And from a political point of view, you know, people say, oh, the Labour Party, you know, went in and didn't do this or didn't do that. I'm proud of the role we played. We didn't do everything right. God mm-hmm. knows we didn't. And if you were fighting a war and making decisions in real time every day, with the consequences saying, if you don't do that now, this is going to happen negatively, of course you're going to make mistakes too. But by and large, you know, the fact that our economy was in a position to support our people during COVID is a testament to the recovery that we put in train in our period in government.
One of the difficult decisions that your party took was changing leader in the middle of the fight. Is that something that was right to have happened, or do you think that was a mistake?
I don't think it was right that it happened. Eamon in his book set out what happened. I mean, it happened as a consequence of the local and European elections.
That's right, yeah.
We expected a bad result. I actually was the one that was tasked with going on RTE radio the morning after the election, the minute that the exit poll was to be announced. And I have to say, I think it was 7% was the figure given, and that was below any of our expectations. Mm. And I knew we had a great difficulty. I had spoken on the day of the election. Eamon had rung me and asked me to meet him, and I came to Dublin, left my own constituency that day, and we discussed what we would do. And one of the things that Eamon had agreed to do is that he would leave the Department of Foreign Affairs, take a more domestic role and a hands-on role on it. Although he was playing a blinder in terms of our economic development and recovery in his role as Minister of Foreign Affairs. But we knew that we were now faced with an existential threat as a party.
Yeah.
But things had moved very quickly, and he felt by Sunday that he should resign. And he did resign on the Monday.
Mm. Do you think the fact that I think it was 7 or 8 of your, I think maybe younger parliamentary party colleagues had gathered with a view to, and maybe it was a kind of a, you know, what are we doing here, guys, type of thing. Mm. But there is a perception that they were there in a bit to oust Eamon Gilmore from his position. Is that your sense of that, of what that meeting was about? Or do you think, is that an unfair...
I was meeting with Eamon and Pat Rabbit when I got a phone call saying that this meeting was happening. Mm. And I sought to find out where it was happening and to ring into it. And it was simply people who just were panicking. They hadn't any strategy.
Yeah.
And most of them regretted being there subsequently. That's the truth of it. It was just, they obviously were concerned about the future of our party. And they were right to be concerned about the future of the party. But my own judgment on it, I can say honestly, I think that had we...
Could he have, say, if he'd batten down the hatches for about 48 hours, could you reckon Eamon Gilmore could have stayed on?
Yes, I do. That'd be my judgment on it.
Did you advise him on that? Or events moving too fast at that
Events
stage?
Were moving too fast. Mm. Once things were going in, things were too precarious generally for us to have an internal political battle.
Mm.
And Eamon knew that immediately.
His successor as Taoiseach is someone who is somewhat seen as a divisive member or figure in your party. Were her actions at that time helpful in that period?
Well, I mean, Joan was a very good colleague, worked assiduously in the Department of Social Protection to protect, by God, she defended social welfare recipients to the annoyance of Fine Gael, I have to tell you, who felt that, and blame me as well for being too supportive of my colleague Minister in Social Protection and not generous enough to others.
Okay, but let's cut to it. She was often seen as being, you know, stirring up trouble for Eamon while he was out of the country, often seen as kind of articulating anti-leadership type because she didn't get your job in the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform. I suppose from your inside role, is that an unfair portrayal of Joan Burton?
Yes.
Very good. In terms of the longer legacy for the Labour Party, let's just take a pause on that one. In terms of the longer legacy of the Labour Party, I mean, is there a way back for the Labour Party? Obviously, we see poll rating, you know, consistently now at below 3% or 5%, I should say. And it is the oldest party in the history of the country and all the rest of it. You know, can it see brighter days again, or is it terminally in trouble?
Well, we've been terminally in trouble since our inception. People have written us off more times than I've had hot dinners. Mm. I was elected, I'm very glad to tell your listeners that I'm 40 years in the Oireachtas now.
Congratulations. Today?
This week. Yeah. This week. I was 4 years in the Senate and 36 years in the Dáil. And when I was elected in 87, our opinion poll rating was 4.6%. Not our opinion poll rating. Our actual poll rating was 4.5%. And people had written us off. Within 4 years of that, we had elected Mary Robinson president. And 2 years after that, we had 33 Dáil deputies led by Dick Spring. Mm. The thing I've learned in my long-term perspective on politics in Ireland is that people making long-term judgments on the basis of today's reality virtually never proved to be the case. Mm. I mean, if you just look at the rise of Sinn Féin, Sinn Féin in the last local elections did miserably, miserably. A few months after the last local elections in 2019, we had four by-elections, which they did their normal average. They won one. In my constituency, we had a by-election. Their candidate got 4,000 votes. 4 months later, in February, the same candidate, who had lost his council seat less than a year earlier, lost his county council seat, got 18,000 first preference votes. Mm. So I had people telling me in the summer of 2019 that Sinn Féin were a washed-up entity. See, fortunes change and events happen. And the thing that the Labour Party has is deep roots in communities and a long history of serving this country. Now, you know, nowadays it almost is a liability to have served in government, not only in Ireland, across Europe, across the world, to have actually served in government, because people want the promise of something fundamentally different that they can have without restriction. And I think people also look to a party of integrity.
Well, we could talk about that for another day.
That's another discussion.
That is. But listen, that's it for now. My thanks to Brendan Howland for joining us on his 40th anniversary of being in the Dáil. This podcast was produced by Paul Hossard and myself, Daniel McConnell. To you, the listener, thank you very much for joining us. Join us next time for another episode of Let Me Tell You. Bye-bye for now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.